welcome you to join us on the porch. Today's show is made possible by VRC Limited. Grab a coffee or a cool lemonade and join our host, Randy Voller, for a slice of life from the perspective of one of Chatham County's most actively engaged community leaders, former mayor, real estate developer, musician, and all-around great guy. Now, here's Randy.
And this is Randy Voller back on the porch, a place where we have conversations with guests. Today we have Henry McCoy. Great to see you, Henry.
Hey, Randy. It's always great to see you.
So, Henry, you are currently on faculty at North Carolina Central with appointments at Duke and Carolina and Harvard. You've come a long way since I first met you years ago, although you already started at a pretty high plateau. You were working in commerce.
Yeah, well, you know, I've moved into the academic space. I've always tried to kind of think about my work through the lens of, you know, not just doing but also thinking. So this corresponds with my philosophy of not doing without thinking and not thinking without doing. So that's how I have ended up in the academic space.
Well, you're known as an entrepreneurship and economic thought leader. What is that?
Well, you know, the economy drives the world, right? I mean, we all look around, like, think about now, you're riding down the road, you're looking at gas prices, and you're probably cringing. But, you know, economic development, entrepreneurship, those are things that drive the marketplace. They create jobs, they create opportunity, they allow for the creation of wealth and things of that nature. And so, you know, being a so-called thought leader, I guess, I spend time trying to better understand a number of things about entrepreneurship and economic development, including everything from, you know, how do we make sure that communities that have historically been left out get access to opportunity? How do we, you know, compete against other states and how do we connect growth and equity? All those kind of things are part of that.
So you mentioned a couple of things that people need to know. So equity, mm-hmm. which is a really important concept and somewhat of a buzzword now, but what do you consider to be equity in the context of what you're doing?
Well, I'll give you a great example. You mentioned, you know, you and I used to spend time together in my commerce days, and you were leading the party and things of that nature.
That happened later, but you were at commerce in the Bev Perdue administration.
I was, and before I was in commerce, I was a banker. I was a banker for about 10 years at the beginning of my career. The bank, if you've been in North Carolina long enough, Central Carolina Bank has grown to become SunTrust and now Truist.
So you worked at CCB?
I did. That was my first job.
Beautiful out of headquarters in downtown Durham, which is now 21C.
21C Hotel. I used to work in that building. I started my career right out of college, out of UNC. I started there in banking when the headquarters was in that spot.
I used to bank there.
Oh, did you? Well, you know,
a lot. Sean Turner was like one of our loan officers, you know, way back in the day, back in the 90s. So, okay, so you came out of college. You went to Carolina?
I did. I went to UNC undergraduate, 91 and 95. Got out on the School of Business and went essentially immediately into banking.
So let's just go back a little bit in time. So when you were at UNC, you were a student. Were you also an athlete?
I was. I ran on the track team. I was a full scholarship athlete at UNC on the track and field team. Ran all 4 years. Two-time All-American. Was a national champion during my senior
really?
Year.
What was your race?
I was a 400-meter runner.
That is a difficult race. It's not quite long distance. It's not quite short distance. It's essentially you're sprinting the whole time.
Yeah, I ran a lot of times around that track, and so yeah, I was my senior year. We won the 4x400-meter national championship in the NCAA. We were at the time number five all time. Yeah, that year we finished the season ranked number one in the U.S. in college and the world.
What was your best time?
So you know, I was able to just split 44 seconds.
Folks. So 44 seconds. Yeah. That's basically 4 11-second 100 meters.
Yeah, well, you know, there were folks you trying to catch or folks you trying to keep them from catching you. So you have to do what you got to do, Randy.
You were running at a time when Michael Johnson was like the king of the track world. He was out in Texas. I mean,
yeah, Waco.
You knew how fast he was.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was running 43s. And, yeah, we, you know, that was really a exciting time, you know, just track and field, and you know, the heyday. I ended up getting married in '96. My wife and I met at UNC. She was on the track team as well. She's an All-American, no kind of teaching fellows, and all those kind of good things. And we ended up getting married in '96, and so we went to the Olympic Games as our honeymoon, and saw Carl Lewis do his last long jump. Saw Michael Johnson running. Had a number of our friends and teammates that were running. Alan Johnson, who ended up winning the 110 hurdles at Atlanta Games. Ken Harnett, who ran with me as part of that national championship relay team. So you know, it was a wonderful time.
Did you ever think that you were going to try to get on the Olympic team?
Well, you know, I think a lot of folks, when you're young and you're an athlete, you think about that highest level. I started running when I was pretty young on a very high level. When I was 12, I won my first national championship when I was 12. And when
you were 12 years old?
Yeah.
Where did you win that?
Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Really?
I did.
Are you from Pennsylvania?
No, I'm from Fayetteville, from here.
But you were from Fayetteville up to Hershey, Pennsylvania, and won the national title?
Yeah, well, you know, the way they do it is you have your local competition that goes up to a regional competition, goes to a state competition, and I was amongst the fastest in the country, so the Hershey Corporation flew us all up to Pennsylvania, got up there. Took us to Hershey Park. Also, you know, took us to the chocolate factory. The whole town smelled like chocolate.
I've been to that chocolate. It smells like chocolate, right.
Yes.
It's an amazing place.
Yeah, got chocolate. I mean, the lights are shaped like Hershey Kisses, the amusement park and all that kind of stuff. But more than that, which has actually ended up impacting my business life going forward, they talked about Milton Hershey and how he never had kids. And so mm-hmm. basically the Hershey fortune got turned over to orphans at the boys' home. And so what I learned during that time when I was 12 years old was that business can be a force of good and all those things. Interesting enough, also the celebrity that they brought to meet everybody was Herschel Walker.
Well, he's certainly in the news now.
So I met Herschel Walker when I was 12 years old. It was his first year in the USFL, I guess, when he was playing for, I guess, Donald Trump.
He's playing for Donald Trump for the New Jersey Generals. I mean, I believe Hershey, Pennsylvania is where Wilt Chamberlain set the record against the Knicks with 100 points in an NBA game.
That is true.
It's an amazing place. It was a company town, but it was also designed, and they did have their workers in mind.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's a fascinating story, about how Milton Hershey, turned over his fortune to the kids and how he tried to take care of the community and things of that nature. So, I mean, it is a fascinating story about how business can be used for good. You know, there's always conflicts, but, I mean, I think certainly he had an ambition of being someone who provided for those in the city.
So you were a young person, you were 12 years old, you went up and you won a national title.
I did.
It's pretty amazing. At a place that we've both been as a kid, I actually lived in Pennsylvania as well. And when we come back from the break, we're gonna pick up the story and we're going to talk about social equity. But I just think that's an amazing story that you won a national title at 12 in Hershey, Pennsylvania. This is Randy Voller with Henry McCoy on the porch. We'll be back after the break.
Welcome back to On the Porch. Randy Voller and his friends bringing local flavor with zesty conversation. Come on up and grab a chair.
And this is Randy Voller back on the porch. We're kicked back here having a nice chat with Dr. Henry McCoy. Henry is a professor over at NC Central, but he also has appointments at Duke, Carolina, and Harvard. Henry, that's a long way you came from starting out in Fayetteville.
Well, you know, I've always wanted to do the best in whatever I can. And so I think that I've been certainly fortunate. I've certainly, you know, worked hard. But, I mean, I just love what I do. I let my passions carry me where they carry me.
So here's a question. I used to have a radio show down in Fayetteville. Been down there a lot. My father was in the military. But I was on We Do at one time on Bragg Boulevard. And as a young man coming out of Fayetteville, going up to Hershey, Pennsylvania, what struck you as an eye-opener as a difference between Fayetteville and Hershey?
Well, you know, so I just to pick up on, my dad spent 35 years at 82nd Airborne, so, you know, we were in Fayetteville.
So you're in the military family as well.
I am, yeah. And WIDU, as you say, I know it well. You know, it was a gospel station.
So, yes.
You know,
it,
We my grandmother had it on all the time, and I've done a few radio shows there, and so it's Fayetteville's my hometown, and the family's still there, and certainly I think one of the big differences between Fayetteville and Hershey, Pennsylvania is just, I mean, Hershey. Well, let me talk about the similarities. I mean, Fayetteville, for all practical purposes, is a military town, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what it is. And, they've expanded it over time to try to be, diversify that base in some of the same ways that Hershey, Pennsylvania is a company town. And so I think that, going to the Pennsylvania, again, smelling the chocolate in the air and the amusement park and all that kind of stuff was a very different experience for me.
Well, one of the things, I actually played a couple of tournaments down at Fayetteville, one softball tournament, one of the hottest days of my life in July. I don't know why anyone organizes them. You're laughing because basically, you're just sweating profusely, can hardly swing the bat. But I'm wondering, this is one of the critiques about essentially the way the South was constructed economically post-war was, they'd say, well, it sits on a three-legged stool, which is essentially low wages, low educational values, low expectations. I don't know if you consider that fair or unfair, but I mean, certainly the wages that were paid up at Hershey were probably higher than the wages that, I've been here over 30 years and what you grew up with.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think some of it is relative, right? Hershey is in a lot of ways, I mean, I would compare Hershey probably more to Chapel Hill, right? I mean, where you certainly have a town that is built around a single institution. Now, the institution in Chapel Hill, of course, is a university, so you have a stratification of incomes. Hershey probably is a bit more flat in terms of that. I guess certainly in a lot of ways, Hershey, because it has such a position within the community, probably in some ways, if you know the history early on, like Hershey was providing homes for people. And I mean, it was
right.
One of those kind of situations.
Which is a really interesting point, because now we're dealing with an affordability crisis with homes. But in their model, they were already thinking of providing the homes.
Yeah. I mean, I think, if you go back in business history, which I get a chance to do and think about entrepreneurship, I mean, I try to think about it from a broad standpoint. There were a number of individuals who, I mean, over time you get, histories of perhaps, you rethink it, and what perhaps somebody thought was a good thing can be a bad thing. Part of it is like, these kind of benevolent kind of town dictates what you want. Somebody runs the town, right?
Right. They're running the town. It's a company town. Pullman had a company town. There were multiple company towns that developed in the 19th century into the 20th century.
Right. I mean, usually, I mean, sooner or later, there's some kind of conflict because, I mean, that paternalistic kind of nature, creates challenges. But they also, if you read the history, people in Hershey, Pennsylvania talk about, they think back to the good old days and the good old years whenever it was more of a company town.
Well, there's a, that it was cohesive or maybe a sense of community. We're doing a later show with Tammy Swearin, and we're going to be talking about community. Community is kind of an elusive quality. We all think we know what it is, but then again, maybe we don't.
Yeah, well, interesting thing, you talked about North Carolina, and certainly, the old adage was, something like, thank goodness for Mississippi or something. I mean, back in the day in terms of economics, because what you had was, we tobacco dependent, things of that nature. Durham at its height was the center of tobacco.
Was
universe.
A tobacco town.
Yeah. The center of the universe for tobacco world. I mean, the Duke family and things of that nature. Over time, wages were abysmally low. And if you think about it now, we're in the Triangle, right? I live in Durham, and you have the Research Triangle Park, which, was opened in 1958 and kind of struggled for a number of years. But, it's interesting history around that. So, Chapel Hill, is the oldest public university in the country. North Carolina, for the most part, has always invested in higher education.
Yes, for the most part, yeah, that was its idea.
Historically, right. And so, but what was happening, I mean, certainly, you got discriminatory things that you can talk about and those kind of things. We do have more minority-serving institutions than anybody in the country with our HBCUs and Pembroke, which is a Native American-serving institution. But
that's a key point for folks who are HBCUs. A lot of folks, if they don't know what that is, say the whole term,
HBCU is a historically black college or university. We have in North Carolina, we have nine of those.
Which is key.
Yeah.
It's played in a very important role, in fact, in developing leadership in the African-American community.
Yeah, and if you know the kind of story behind it, it's interesting because part of that drive was because there was a desire not to integrate, right?
And right.
So like, oh, well, we could get your school over there. And so, but you ended up with, like, that's how the law school ended up at Central NCCU because UNC Chapel Hill was like, well, we don't really think we want to integrate right now.
And it turns out that Central has a tremendous law school. I mean, you have Duke, you have Central and Carolina all right here.
Right, right, right. So it ended up creating an incredible ecosystem. But what was happening was there was this investment in education. So just imagine like this, North Carolinian kids growing up, they go into the university system. 4 years later, they come out and they say, well, what am I supposed to do? You look around and say, I'm not going back to the farm or whatever the case. So we were subsidizing in North Carolina folks going, getting educated, going off to New York and California, Chicago, things like that.
They were leaving. They were going up the East Coast, going to Baltimore.
Yeah. And so really that's what the RTP sense became. Well, how do we recapture that talent that comes off the farm, goes through education, and then comes out of the university? Well, maybe we can recapture them in our own kind of hub.
Well, I mean, one of the things that you brought up was Durham. I can remember when I first came here in 1990-91, you could still smell tobacco when you came actually down the Durham Freeway.
Right.
Of course, a lot of folks may not know that the Durham Freeway, you know, destroyed the Haight-High neighborhood, mm-hmm. and it essentially destroyed the Black Wall Street.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's urban renewal is something that affected blacks all over the United States. And Durham's Haight-High community was once the centerpiece of black economic progress.
I mean, that's something people should remember. We had the centerpiece of black economic progress right here in Durham years ago. This is Randy Voller with Dr. Henry McCoy. We're on the porch. We'll be back after the break.
Welcome back to On the Porch. Randy Voller and his friends bringing local flavor with zesty conversation. Come on up and grab a chair.
And we're back. This is Randy Voller, and we're still on the porch kicking it with Dr. Henry McCoy. Henry, we were having a great conversation before the break. So, you know, I noticed when I was looking up your bio that, among other things, you're an affiliated faculty member of the Samuel Dubois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke. So kind of tell our audience the importance of social equity and what your role is and what you're doing there.
Oh, yeah. So the Dubois or the Cook Center is run by a kind of distinguished professor, Dr. William Sandy Darity, who a lot of people know from his work around, you know, reparations and things of that nature. Social equity really looks at this idea of how do you make sure that, you know, every group of population is kind of getting their fair share of what I always call the good and the bad, right? I mean, you know, you put your hand into a marble jar with a lot of different colors. If you say, well, hey, who's going to be wealthy? Put your hands in the jar, you pull it out. It shouldn't be all one color marble, right? I mean, it should be some percentage point. Just like say, oh, well, who's all going to jail? Put your hand in the marble. I mean, it shouldn't be just one color. And so with social equity, what you try to do is figure out, well, you know, what are the impediments to that kind of equity that prevents that? And so the Cook Center does that kind of research. I just did a talk yesterday, a Juneteenth talk in Goldsboro, about the economic and entrepreneurship inequity aspects of North Carolina and kind of where different races land and where they sit. Man. So it becomes a critical part when we start thinking about the other chasms like education and health and all those kind of things. The economic aspect is a centerpiece of that.
This is incredibly important work, especially, I think, because people don't understand the difference between equality and equity.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, equality, a lot of times, so you also talk about something like fairness, right? I mean, there may be a process that's fair because though everybody gets the same, opportunity per se. So, hey, you know, come in. Everybody has a same chance to do this. But equity takes into account historic nature, right? We talked about track earlier. I come from track world. Well, equality and fairness may say, well, hey, you know, we're putting together an Olympic team. So everybody come out and you know, here's the rules. This is how you make team top three, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you have one group of people, say, in a basement somewhere for years, and you wouldn't let them practice, you wouldn't let them compete, all these kind of things. And then one day you open up the door and say, hey, come out and compete. Well, the process may be, you know, fair and equitable from the standpoint, but it doesn't take equity into consideration.
It may be open for everyone to compete, but yes, it doesn't take into account that they might not have track shoes.
Yeah, exactly. And that the reason they don't have track shoes might be a systematic reason. And so equity takes in a much bigger lens of understanding the historic context of how different groups have gotten to their position, and then try to figure out, well, you know, in some areas, you're not trying to slow down one group. You're just trying to figure out how do you help speed up folks who have been, you know, intentionally left off that pathway.
I mean, one of the most interesting maps I've ever seen, I worked with a fellow who was in Farrington Village, which is south of here, but he was a retired professor from Harvard, actually. And we were looking at the 2010 census, and then we overlaid data sets from that census actually with an old map showing concentrations of slaves in 1860. And what you find is a lot of the trends that you still saw in 2010 were actually like in the Black Belt and, you know, in Warren County and going east and in places that had historically had these issues.
Yeah, well, you know, those systems tend to last a long time.
They tend to last a long time. Well, this has been Randy Voller with Henry McCoy. We're going to be back for part two with Henry McCoy. Please visit us with Randy Voller on the porch.